this has nothing to do topically with where I'm headed, but I find the interconnectedness of things so intriguing. The on the plus side of that is that the potential for connecting good things that we might otherwise treat as though they were enemies of one another is enormous and beautiful. On the minus side, if you will, it's that I sometimes feel like the things that matter the most are often very hard for us to see. You know, it's all kind of, all the stuff right here is so occupying, all the stuff that's in our face, all the stuff that comes in and out of our daily lives takes so much of our time and attention that sometimes it feels like we need a whack in the side of the head to take the time to look deeper. We've been exploring this topic of anxiety for the past while. We've had a lovely sort of two-week rerouting, if you will, from that particular exploration with Wally sharing some of the indigenous perspectives and his personal perspectives on healing, and Karen also spending a morning with us last week unpacking her poem, Two Cities. To me, both of those occasions felt like thin places. They felt like experiences that were that kind of whack on the side of the head, you know, just a step away from the pattern. And they helped me find it a little bit easier to sense the presence of the divine in everyday things like rhythm, in the case of our conversation about the drum and our heartbeat, the aliveness of the earth and the river, your work, Karen. And in all of that, the struggle for us as humans to make stories that speak of the meaning of the world around us. That this is a thing that we just can't seem to stop doing. And why would we? And I think it's also easy to forget, especially if you grew up around certain versions of religion, it's easy to forget that when we do things that we regard as so normal that we don't tend to think about them in spiritual terms, if you will, we do things like science. That's the same project. That's humans going, what does this mean? That's us trying to find a story that we can actually sing to ourselves and go, that's all right. I can live there. Which is one of the reasons why, for so many of us, we're totally comfortable, generally speaking, with practical science. We live our lives there. And yet, if we stand back from that comfort just a little bit, we can also see that there are things about that story that have been told in a certain way that, if we swallow them whole, do not go where we want our meaning-making to go. They take us to places like mercury poisoning, right? They take us to places like only growth is okay. They take us to places like there's no room for the things that we can't explain with this story. Categorically, any story that says there's no room for things that we can't explain with this story has a problem, like an enormous unsolvable problem at its heart, and an enormous hubris as well. Those are not healthy stories. I don't care what they're called. They're not a healthy story. And that's one of the things that keeps me intrigued with the Jesus stories, is that partly just by time and distance, I think, there's some ambiguity about a lot of them. There's some openness about them. And the tradition in which they stand seems to have felt and continue to feel very free to play with them. One of my favorite writers in this regard, a guy named Capon, talks about holy horsing around. That's what he calls it, right? The tradition of coming to the story and saying, how many different ways could we read this? The stuff that keeps our imaginations open, keeps them lively. I love that we get to do what we do together here. I love that we get to gather to explore what we believe, and I love that we get to do that with, well, I'm going to say, a minimum of fuss. I'm not saying that there's no work to keeping something like the table going. There's plenty of work. That's both sort of the visible work of a Sunday morning gathering like this, when there's a bunch of people that show up early to set things up and stay late to take them down, that plan and rehearse music for us to share together, that do the work of making sure that our image making and sharing tools are working, that make and clean up the coffee, we could keep going. Not, that's sort of the visible part when we get together, and there's also the less visible part that has to do with our leadership team's function and the work of kind of running the organization, that is the below the waterline part of life at the table. Those tax receipts that Justin just showed up with this morning didn't just show up this morning, for instance, right? This space didn't just magically have keys in my mailbox one morning, you know? Like, there's all these things, right? Having said all of that, in reviewing this past year in my own kind of time, as we approach our annual open meeting, I was struck again by how uniquely lean this community is, at least in organizational terms. We don't own very much, but we don't need to. We're, as part of reviewing our own status as an organization, as a leadership team, one of the things that we're doing is we need to revisit our missing in action bylaws. Again, a legal sort of thing that we need to do. And as part of my research into that, I started looking around Canada and kind of going, so we didn't have to start with a blank sheet of paper, who could I talk to out there that does something like this and say, how did you guys handle this? Because we don't quite fit the grid. And I don't just mean we don't fit the grid of the megachurch. I mean, we don't even fit the grid of the CRA. We kind of have to. But they have their own idea about what a religious institution is and what it does. And it's not a ringer. This community's not a ringer for those definitions. And so some creativity is required. You don't want to be too creative with the CRA, right? That's speaking of organizations that might not have a lot of imagination as their front line. It's more about regulation than imagination. But still, so I started kind of casting around and going, who are communities out there that are doing something like this from a somewhat similar perspective? That's a really short list as far as I can tell. Or they're not visible, like they're hard to find, right? Which I think is probably more the case. Total aside, but hard to find, the perspective of the people that are doing the things that are like this, that's the perspective I want and can't find. I have a young friend, family friend, who's a filmmaker, among other things. They're working on a documentary about the North, which is like the far North, the Innu part of the continent. And he grew up there as a child and now lives down here in southern Manitoba. But so I met a bunch of his buddies, his university-age guys. They got some funding from Google, whoop whoop, and they're making this film about the Innu people and their experience as the world changes. And he said the other day to my son, who's a good friend of his, he said, you know what, this whole polar bears are vanishing thing? He says, they're not vanishing. Polar bears, there's more polar bears. You ask the Innu people, they'll say there's more bears than they've seen for ages. But their migration patterns are changing as the climate shifts. And so when the team of like white guys show up in Innu country to count the polar bears, they show up when they always showed up. But the polar bears aren't there. Oh my God, there's no polar bears. No, that's right, they come 2 weeks later. If they'd ask any of the people who live up there, they'd tell them there's lots of bears, you're here at the wrong time. Same problem with some of these other kinds of examinations. I want to talk to the people that are doing what we're doing, but I can't find them. I don't think that's a good reason to conclude that they're not there. And I can't really believe that when I look around this community, I think about the conversations I get to have with people. This is happening all over the place. But it's not happening when it did. It's not happening in the way that it did. And so when we get into this structural stuff as a community, one of the things that I'm struck by is how much room we have to move because of the leanness, the simplicity, relatively speaking, of the organization. We don't have to deal with infrastructure. Infrastructure, and I've been part of big churches, this is not theoretical for me. Infrastructure can take a lot of community energy. And did we mention time and did we mention money? Right? Like, it just takes a lot of oomph to take care of buildings. And I don't know if you know this, but for this community, not owning infrastructure has some important positive implications. And I was struck again because I did sort of find a community in BC that's doing something like this. I got a hold of the guy, Bradley, lovely person. We had a great chat. We agreed that it's really nice to talk to somebody else who feels like, so you don't feel less like you're on an island in this particular role. From this perspective, that was great. And I said, could you send me your bylaws? No problem. Send me the bylaws. I'm looking through these bylaws. And there's this big section in there about who gets the money if the thing folds and the property gets sold. Well, that's a good thing to take care of as an organization and to be crystal clear about, right? But when they were writing their bylaws, they were very concerned because there was this building and it was worth a bunch of money and there'd been a big scrap when the church split about who gets the building and blah, blah, blah. So they were dealing with it in the bylaws, right? And I'm reading through it and it's this big section relative to the length of the whole document. And I'm thinking, wow, it's kind of nice to not have to write that section. And I don't know if you've thought about this from this vantage point, but being relatively simple as an organization, I think, can help us be healthier as an organism. And what I mean by that is that that simplicity frees us up to do certain things. It means that I think we can be part of making better use of the things that are already on the earth. This is one more morning that this place isn't empty and heated, right? That's good. We get to do that. It means that we can support things like Creative Manitoba, the organization that leases this space, which supports the creative arts in the province and who's undergoing, like many arts organizations, a staggering tightening of their budget because of loss of funding. We can be part of them keeping the doors open. That's a good thing. Arts matter. Another day we can unpack that, but I'm just going to say it like it was true and carry on. It means that we can support things like Slam Camp, which we'll hear more about at our annual open meeting, or Freedom School. Also, initiatives that, in the process of working with newcomers to Canada and helping to welcome them and face the challenges of new country, language, culture, and climate zone, also works with a reclaimed space in the heart of the city. It means that we have less to worry about. And that can help us free up resources like time and energy and money to try to do some good in the world that would otherwise be occupied in other ways. And I think those are good things. I'm not trying to say this is a superior way to operate, but I am happy to affirm it as our way to operate and to point out that it has some unique positives to it. And I want us to be aware of that. I don't want that to just slide off into the shadows. We've been working our way through this not bare minimum Jesus explorations. I've been struck by a few parallels between this community's way of being in the world and the way that Jesus operated in the world. Among them, that Jesus definitely took infrastructure light as a way of life. Nowhere to lay his head is how the writer of the Gospel of Matthew would have it. In the wider teachings of Jesus, that's a statement that can be understood as a way of saying, if you wanted to think about this as the voice of Jesus speaking, as a son of man, which is the way Jesus often referred to himself, which just means human. As a son of man, I'm on about more than building and accumulating, I'm on about what's going on with the people around me more than with the stuff around me. And that is not a Jesus mini rant against owning a home or having a building in which to gather a community. Jesus unapologetically made use of both those things and others like them on many occasions. But I think it is a way of saying keep some perspective, keep the more important things in their proper place, and the rest of the stuff is more likely to behave itself well. Because we all know how stuff can misbehave, right? When I was growing up, we used to sing this this little chorus in Sunday school, the lyrics of which went, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God." Seek ye first, anyone? Yeah, head's nodding, okay. And the next line is, "And all these things will be added unto you." Right? And it's the lyric is a quote from Matthew 6, in which Jesus offers this considerable extended teaching about all of this work to keep your perspective stuff. And it bugs me, personally, bugs me more than a little when I hear a text like that getting used to justify the thinking that if we would just keep the religious rules, the phrase seek first the kingdom and righteousness is considerably deeper than keep the religious rules, but it can easily be kind of transliterated that way. If you just kind of keep the religious rules, then what you're going to do is you're going to end up with a lot of stuff. Right? You're going to be rich because that's how it works. You pull the obedience lever and the money comes out of the machine. For Jesus, this son of man, the action was where the people were. And lasting treasures, to use the language of those texts, had to do with that realm, not with the consumables. And we'll kind of come back to that idea a little bit more, not this morning, but another time. But then, as now, a lot of what occupied the humans that Jesus was talking with had to do with money. I'm not going to talk about money this morning, by the way. But that's what that whole first part of that chapter of Matthew is about. It's all Jesus talking about money. And then we come to Matthew 6:25, and the conversation shifts. And I want to read you the text. I'm going to read you kind of this whole chunk, okay? So this is Matthew 6:25-34. For those of you who've been feeling like you're going into like Bible anemia, I'm going to just... There's a little iron for you all here. We know who we are. Priest and sister. All right. Anyway, here we go. Wow, where did that all come from? Therefore, so we know we're in Bible land right away. Who else starts sentences with therefore, unless they're being pompous? Therefore, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not much more valuable than they? We could like spend a month on that sense. Can any of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon in all of his splendor was dressed like one of these. And if that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will God not much more clothe you, you of little faith? So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. Here's the chorus lyric. And all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. I love the personification of tomorrow in that sentence. Anyway, the shift here is from Jesus talking about money to Jesus talking about worry. Pretty standard human connection, right? Then as now, the connection between money and worry, that's sort of standard fare, probably for most of us. Especially if we equate money with survival. Not an unreasonable equation. By the way, I mentioned in the blurb that there are some differences between anxiety and worry. I'm going to unpack that in a bit, but just so you know, for now I'm going to treat them as basically the same thing, because in textual terms that's going to be helpful. And also, before we go any further, I feel like I maybe need to address something. I hope this isn't true, but I suspect that for some of us in this room, just hearing me read that text set your teeth on edge. Or made you just want to run out of the room. Which, by the way, and I say this as kindly and from my heart as possible, you're always free to do at the table. Okay, like actually. This is important. For the table to be well as a community, it needs to be easy to leave. Because you can't explore safely otherwise, right? Because then you're just getting herded somewhere. Not a great idea. So if you need to leave, leave. I'm not going to be offended. I might be intrigued personally, but I won't be offended for what that's worth. There's a reason why that happened inside some of us. Some of us have heard this text applied in a way that suggests that to worry is to fail. And not sort of to fail generically, it's to fail God. Anybody here ever, don't show me your hands, anybody here ever been accused of the sin of worry? Or heard somebody else being accused of that? That's this text, right? So some of us have heard this preached and taught as though to worry is like a failure of character. It's a lack of moral fiber. It's to let the people around us that are depending on us to be godly adults that don't worry. Godly is in air quotes out loud and in actual quotes in my notes. We've been told that somehow to worry demonstrates a lack of maturity, and if we're a follower of Jesus, if that's our path, that somehow if we're worrying, we're off the path. When you have been hit over the head with a stick, it's really hard to look at the same stick and go, I might need that to prop me up, right? Like, it's really hard to do that. It's really hard to come to the same story or the same text or the same kind of genesis of an idea and go, there's more than one way to read that story when the way that it was read or taught to you hurt. That's hard to do. So if you're in that situation, I wanted to acknowledge it, I wanted to name it, and then I want to carry on, because looking at the stick that might have beaten you as potentially a good thing in your life, a support in your life, is something I want to try to do anyway. So here's the thing. We are hardwired as humans for anxiety. Right? This is how it works. I recently heard somebody describe anxiety, I recently heard somebody describe disordered anxiety, an important distinction, as our body doing the right thing at the wrong time in the wrong amount, which I found a super helpful description. I'm about to describe anxiety as a good thing in the next few moments, so It's important to make it clear that when I do that, I'm not talking about the disordered versions of anxiety. Okay? This is a very important distinction in what I'm about to do. If anxiety is something in your life that messes you up, that locks you up, that makes it hard for you to go about your everyday life, what I'm about to talk about is not what you are experiencing. Okay? So just, I don't want to waste our time with this. I also don't want to lack clarity about that. So stay with me on this, if you can. What you're experiencing, if you're experiencing disordered anxiety, is the right thing at the wrong time in the wrong amounts. If you need to leave the room because what I'm saying about anxiety just feels like it so doesn't match your experience, and that would serve you better, then please do. Here's a very simple version of what we know these days about anxiety. At its core, anxiety is one of the significant reasons that we are still here as a species. It's our body's way of gearing up to face danger or threat. And that is why when we experience anxiety, our pulse goes up, our breathing gets faster, we feel like we just chugged a whole case of Red Bull. We're just like, wah! Right? We're amped up. That's sort of the short version of the biology of anxiety. Our body is doing what it's evolved to do. It's getting us ready to either fight or to run or to hold very, very still, to freeze. Whatever our intuition or instinct or experience suggests would serve us best under this threat. So our body's gearing up to do that. That's the experience that we call anxiety in general terms. That's sort of that root connection, that protection from incoming threat. That's the root connection to the experience of scarcity that we talked about a few weeks ago and its linkage to anxiety. We experience anxiety if we perceive something to be a threat to our survival, and if we equate getting a certain job as essential to our survival, or salvaging a particular relationship, or responding in a self-protective way to a nasty text, whatever it is that we perceive as a threat to our existence, to our survival, that's what our body is going to respond to by gearing us up physiologically to face it, or to run away from it, or to be very, very still until it goes away. That's what I mean when I say that we're hardwired for anxiety. So, in that context, Jesus saying, don't worry about your life, does not mean do not experience anxiety. That would be like saying, don't breathe, right? Especially when you're in trouble or facing a threat. Don't breathe. It is built in. We need anxiety like we need oxygen. However, like with oxygen, too much of it will kill you. We're not actually wired for pure oxygen. We can overdo it. It's not dangerous. In fact, not experiencing it is dangerous. But it is uncomfortable to experience anxiety. One of the interesting things about, again, not disordered anxiety, but anxiety kind of as a root experience, is that it's uncomfortable because our body's not meant to be in that state all the time. This is one of the things that's really challenging if we have an anxiety disorder, is we're just getting too much of this for too long, right? And that's not how it's supposed to work, and that's why we need to respond to that. But even though it's uncomfortable, generally speaking, if it's ordered, if it's sort of, if you want the natural version, it's going to decrease and it's going to pass. And the other thing is it's adaptive, and so anxiety actually helps us when it's working the way that it should. So when all that body stuff kicks in because there's some threat, that's what gives us the zip to get our kid's hand before they step off the curb. Right? And now when we talk about disordered anxiety, we spend so much time on that conversation, necessarily and importantly, we should, but it's easy to forget that underneath the disordered experience, there is an ordered one that we actually need and that can serve us well. Right? So that's the distinction. But when it gets out of hand, it can be trouble. Kind of like this metaphor, Anxiety Canada illustrates the difference between those ideas of anxiety this way. Think of anxiety like fog. If it covers everything, makes it hard to see, stops you from doing what you usually do, and generally gets in the way, then it has likely become a problem. In small amounts, we can maneuver through the fog and get to our destination. But when the fog is so thick, we're grounded. It's time to take action. So that's the metaphor they use on their website, talking about that distinction. So when Jesus says, don't worry about your life, or when Paul's riffing on Jesus in Philippians and says, be anxious about nothing, which is a fairly crisp statement about anxiety linguistically, we should probably either toss the text out as irrelevant, possibly even harmful. Some of us have had that experience. Or we should explore to see if this is one of those time-bound ideas where the wisdom of Jesus just fails to translate to the 21st century, or we should see if there's something else going on here. Right? Those are sort of the options. And I'm going to take the last one because this is what we're here to do, is explore. So with a little help, for a little help in this regard, I'm going to read from what might strike you as a rather cheesy dramatization. When was the last time at the table you were subjected to a cheesy dramatization involving Jesus? We don't do this here very much. Today's your day. So a long chunk of biblical text and a cheesy Jesus dramatization in one morning. This is like big drink of cold water, right? Okay. Anyway, so I'm good. This is a conversation between the devil's advocate and Jesus and an American journalist named Tom Krattenmaker, who is the author of the piece. And I mentioned the American because there's a little bit of context here. And so this is a conversation about the Matthew text that I just read to us a few moments ago between those three characters, devil's advocate, Jesus, and Tom. I will not do voices. Okay. No, I didn't know what to do for devil's advocate. Like, it didn't matter what I chose for devil's advocate. It turned out to be, like, prejudicial. Like, just it was just bad. I just couldn't find it. Like, which race do you want to assign the devil's advocate to? Anyone? Yeah, exactly. So no voices. Devil's advocate. Oh, robot. Oh, but that makes like technology like categorically evil. I could do a mobster, right? Oh, man, I got to go home and practice. I'm going to stay away from the voices. Okay, devil's advocate. They've just heard the Matthew text. Don't worry, huh? Seriously? Try telling that to the cavemen we evolved from. If they didn't worry about the saber-toothed tigers or those incredibly scary bears they had back then, none of us would be here today. It's all about survival, everyone. Jesus is being naive. Jesus. Okay, so I was going to do like a from the Bronx Jewish accent for Jesus. Now, you can't do that either, right? Like, it just doesn't work. Jesus. Don't encourage me. Okay, Jesus. How many saber-toothed tigers did you encounter on the way to work today? Devil's advocate turning to Tom. What about Tom, our hapless author here, and the time he decided to take his then-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, I might add, and small daughter to spend a few days on the north shore of Lake Superior? Was a spur-of-the-moment thing, rather uncharacteristic of you, Tom, now that I think about it. But do you remember that incident? No, we don't need a reservation, you assured your soon-to-be ex. We'll find a room at one of those little motels or cabin resorts up there, no problem. Never mind that the fall colors were peaking and everyone else in Minneapolis and St. Paul was also heading up there for the weekend. Tom, how much did you enjoy being turned away at inn after inn as the afternoon and then the evening wore on? And how much fun was it to drive back to St. Paul in the middle of the night with your furious soon-to-be ex? Tom, that sucked. Devil's advocate. So, don't you agree it pays to worry? Tom, totally. It's experiences like these, and I can tick off a bunch of other examples too, that explain why I have a hard time believing that everything is going to be okay, despite what my old friend Ron used to say and despite what Jesus seems to be saying. Furthermore, Jesus interrupting, may I say something, please? You are missing my point. I'm not saying you should be stupid like Tom was the time he went up to Lake Superior, when any fool could have, I know, right? Like, a better translation, Jesus would say stupid more often, but he says things like, oh, you have little faith, instead. So it's way more Paulish. Any fool could have told him that all the rooms would be taken. I'm not saying the cavemen should have gone up to the saber-toothed tigers and tried to pet them. I'm not saying we shouldn't be smart and think things through. I'm talking about worry here. And that is very different. Devil's advocate. Sounds like hair-splitting to me. Jesus, far from it. There's a huge difference. There's the practice of examining situations with a clear, calm head, which I strongly recommend. And then there's worry. Worry is aimless and endless. It's counterproductive. It doesn't add even one cubit, hour, to your lifespan, or I might add to the quality of your life either. In fact, just the opposite. Thus far, the reading of Tom Krattenmacher. So all this, in terms of this writer's imagination, from the guy who fell asleep in the back of the boat when everybody else thought it was going to sink, right? We'll get into this more in the weeks to come, but for now, let's just kind of consider this. Incorporating the genius of Jesus on worry into our lives does not mean that we need to stop using good judgment or common sense. It doesn't mean that we need to lapse into some kind of literalist moralisms about the sin of worry, or that we need to try to stop our bodies from doing what they are evolved to do. It doesn't mean being irresponsible. It doesn't mean becoming willfully blind to the challenging realities of our circumstances or our times, or for that matter, our systems of belief. It might mean learning to recognize worry for what it is. Here's a lovely word pair. Heard somebody describe worry this week as a pernicious plague. Whoop! A pernicious plague of the mind that prompts us to turn molehills into mountains, that sucks us into treating imagined worst-case scenarios as though they were objective realities and then experiencing them, having emotional responses to them as if they were real, and then wondering why we can't sleep, think clearly, or enjoy any peace of mind. When Jesus says, don't worry, he isn't advising us to abandon complex, responsible thinking or to try to shut down our self-protective anxiety reflexes. That's not what's going on. I think Jesus is inviting us to abandon that pernicious plague, that habit of mind that we use a word like worry for, the habit of mind in which we add multi-layered fear, anticipation, and emotion to things that either don't exist or that are not within our control, and then getting stuck in the cycle of that instead of moving forward. When our body amps it up, it doesn't just amp up our muscles. It amps up our brain, too. There's a reason why all those things rush in when we experience anxiety. They don't all rush in because we have failed to not worry. They all rush in because we are trying to be prepared for anything. And that includes a bunch of things that we don't know, right? What does that sound mean? What does this experience mean? What's going to happen next? What's happening to this person that I love but can't be in touch with, can't contact? What's it? We don't do ourselves any favors sometimes just by the cultural context we're in, where we can often get information so quickly. There's something lovely about it sometimes, but often it doesn't help when it comes to anxiety, because we'll talk more about this again in the weeks to come, but because we don't learn when things are actually not within our control. We can have the illusion that they are. How many of you have seen Springsteen on Broadway, his solo show? Okay, now that's a thing that I'm actually happy to say y'all should do that. About which I don't do very often. It's so worth the time. It's utterly remarkable, even if you're not a Springsteen fan. Just as a life storytelling, it's a staggering piece of work, very beautiful. One point there, though, he tells a story about being a 20-year-old in this rock and roll band that got a gig in one side of the U.S. when they actually all lived on the other side, and they have to drive across the country in like 3 days nonstop with a flatbed truck with their gear and the station wagon. And in Nashville, they get separated, and there's no cell phones. So he says, he stops the whole show and he's like, young people, think about it. No devices. When you lose someone in a world with no devices, they're lost to you. Like they're gone from your life, right? So just that kind of an experience, and hearing somebody of that age talk about when a 20-year-old kind of having this experience of losing half of the band and still trying to get everybody to San Francisco, right? And you just listen to it with imagination to that story and realize, oh, there's so many ways in which our interconnectedness actually makes it very hard for us to do what Jesus is pointing to here, which is get a grip on what is within our control and what isn't. And that's sort of the terrain we're going to explore. And I know that being invited to leave something we know for something we don't know is exactly the sort of situation that provokes worry. And so this might be a truly lousy place to leave off, but I'm going to anyway because, you know, clock's ticking. But next week, what we're going to do is explore around this Jesus perspective of living in the moment for the sake of things that actually transcend time. So there is a way to develop habits of mind, among other things, that can help us with managing well the experience we naturally have when we feel under threat. A lot of it has to do with perception, not surprisingly. So we're gonna talk about that. All right. Even if it's not all right, I'm gonna quit now. Peace.